of webinars that's going to...
Your conference is being recorded.
That's going to focus on learning how to have impact for real change and ensure that the parent voice continues to be heard loud and clear. Before we get started, a few things. I'm going to talk a little bit about what National Place is, but first, understand that we are recording this webinar, as you just heard, and we're going to have everybody mute their phones at this time, and that is *6. If you have comments, you can type them into the chat box, that way that, because we anticipate having quite a crowd on this webinar, we won't be playing that awkward phone silent stuff of let me talk, no, it's my turn. So anyway, National Place. Let me first tell you our mission, which is empowering families and family-led organizations, supporting them to advocate for enhanced, meaningful parent involvement and leadership in all policy decision-making that impact services for children and families who experience disabilities. And this organization was born because several of us saw how what was at first a gradual, but now it seems a very fast erosion on how policies were being made and decided upon and how the family perspective was really seeming to be minimized a lot. So we decided we needed to do something about it. And hence the National Place was born. And we're really excited about this launch by doing these webinars. I want to introduce Diana Autan, who's going to be conducting this webinar. Diana is an attorney, a parent, the director of the National Center for Parent Leadership, Advocacy, and Community Empowerment, and also is the co-director for the National Center on Parent-Family Professional Partnerships, a partnership with Family Voices, the Statewide Parent Advocacy Network, which is New Jersey's PTI, the Family-to-Family Health Information Center, Parent-to-Parent Program, and a chapter of the Federation for Families of for Children's Mental Health. Diana's going to be conducting this. I hope that you will stay tuned throughout this webinar because we're going to talk more about how you can learn more about PLACE and future activities. And please consider joining us if you haven't already to make sure your voice and the voice of the families you work with continues to be represented loud and clear. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Diana.
Thanks, Nora. And as you can see on the slide, National Place is a new national nonprofit organization. We really are focused on making sure that the voices of families are meaningfully impacting decisions that children and families care about. And we have a special interest in making sure that the voices of families who face the greatest challenges due to disability, special health care needs, poverty, and discrimination are heard. We are a coalition of nonprofit family-driven organizations, and right now we have 30 national, state, and local family-led organizational members, which is very exciting. The founding members of National Place were the Exceptional Children's Assistance Center in North Carolina, Matrix, who you just heard from. Hello? In California, Parent to Parent of Georgia, Parent Center in Colorado, the Statewide Parent Advocacy Network from New Jersey, and Wisconsin Facets. And so what are we going to talk about today? We are going to talk about what is lobbying, and we're going to talk about grassroots lobbying as well as direct lobbying. We're going to answer the question, can nonprofits lobby? Should you elect the 501H expenditure test, and what is that? How can you influence policy without lobbying? What are legislative scorecards, and what are some strategies to be able to get the funds to lobby? And as you join the call, please be sure to put yourself on mute. Thank you. And as you go along, if you have any questions, please put them in the chat box. So right now, we're actually going to ask you to participate. We're going to ask you to put something in the chat box and put down one issue you really care about, health, disability, child care, education, justice, poverty, diversity, et cetera. So please just put one topic that you care about, one topic that's the reason that you joined our webinar today. Seeing a lot of issues: disability, health care, diversity and equity, police brutality. Healthcare financing, mental health parity, special education, education in general. That's great. You can leave just one more minute if anybody hasn't had a chance to put what they one issue that they care about. And please be sure to put your line on mute if you're right now. Thank you. All right. So we have a wide range of interests among the participants who are on our webinar today. And that's great, because these are all issues that impact children and families, and we need to have people who care passionately about these issues and who are willing to do something about them, including lobbying. So let's start off talking about making sure that we all understand what lobbying is. And there really are two primary kinds of lobbying. There's direct lobbying, and there's grassroots lobbying. And there are a couple of reasons why it's important to know this, you know, the difference between the two types, and we will talk about that later in a little bit. So direct lobbying is communication with a legislator or with your members, if you are a membership organization, expressing a view about specific legislation or asking your members to be in touch with legislators. That's direct lobbying. So direct lobbying, you yourself are talking to a legislator, or you're asking your members to talk to legislators. Grassroots lobbying is communication with the broader public, expressing a view about specific legislation, and including a call to action. So if you're not a specific membership organization and you're sending out a call to action to the general public, then that's grassroots lobbying. So what is communication? I'm a lawyer, and the laws about lobbying are very particular about what different terms mean. So communication is a conversation in person or on the phone, letter, email, fax, any other creative mechanism to convey a message. And who is a legislator? A legislator is the member of a legislative body, like a city council, a state legislature, the U.S. Congress, and their staff. It's also an executive, like a mayor or a governor or a president, when they are vetoing or signing a bill or making a decision about whether to veto or sign a bill. But it's not an administrative body. So regulations are not legislation, and thus, it's not lobbying when you are talking to an administrative body about regulations. And, yes, anybody who's you do have to call in, and that is information is being put in the chat box. So who is the public? Communication to the public, and that's anybody who is not a legislator or a member of your organization, is the public, and communication to them is grassroots lobbying. Communication to your members, and that's somebody who is either given more than a small amount of time or money to your organization, is direct lobbying. And what does it mean to express a view about legislation? So first of all, legislation is a bill or a resolution that's been introduced in a legislative body, or propose legislation. So legislation could include legislation that has been introduced, like legislation to block grant Medicaid, as well as bills that have actually been introduced in a legislative body. It also includes budget appropriations. It includes tax levels, you know, things, laws that deal with taxation, and also attempts to influence the confirmation of judicial and executive branch nominees. So all the family organizations on this webinar who tried to discourage the appointment of the current Secretary of Education or the current Secretary of Health and Human Services or the current Director of the Medicare and Medicaid Agency, that outreach to influence the confirmation of judicial and executive branch nominees is expressing a view about legislation. It doesn't include regulations, as I said before. It doesn't include expressing a view about executive orders. It doesn't include expressing a view about litigation. So, for example, in the recent U.S. Supreme Court case that just came down that held that special education is supposed to provide more than a de minimis benefit to students with disabilities, there were many family organizations that signed on to amicus briefs to support the student and family in that case. That's not anything to do with legislation, that's litigation. So therefore, that is not expressing a view about legislation. And it also doesn't include enforcement of existing legislation. So if legislation already exists and you're advocating to get that legislation enforced, whether that's the rights of people under Medicaid or child care laws or education laws or disability rights, trying to get those existing laws enforced is also not lobbying because it's not expressing a view about legislation or trying to influence legislation. Now, it doesn't include calls for adequate funding unless there is a budget proposal before the legislature. So once the legislature has put forth a budget proposal or the governor has put forth a budget proposal or the president has put forth a budget proposal that is in the legislature, then it is legislation. But when after a budget has been passed or many months before the budget proposal has been introduced, calling for adequate funding for education or health care or early childhood programs or mental health lobbying, that's not legislation. It doesn't include general concepts for solving problems that haven't yet been reduced to legislative proposals. So what does it mean to be a call to action? So a call to action is encouraging the recipient of your communication to take lobbying action. So it would tell them to contact the legislator. It would provide information on how to contact the legislator. It would provide a way to contact the legislator. It would identify a legislator as being opposed to or undecided about the organization's view on the legislation, or as being a member of a legislative committee, or as being the recipient's legislator. This is all something that's a call to action. And why is it important to know whether it's a call to action? Because once it's a call to action, then it is lobbying. Now, a call to action exists only when it really is trying to direct the people who get the message to take action. And if once you do that, then you are really encouraging people to lobby. Now, it's very important to be careful if you're trying to avoid lobbying on a particular topic to make sure that you do not engage in these activities. You could, for example, share information about potential legislation that is pending and tell the recipient of the message who the people are who are on the legislative committee that's going to consider that, but not take a position on it and not encourage people to take a position on it, and then it's not a call to action. It's merely educational. Now, what about ballot measures? Well, a ballot measure activity is direct lobbying. It is not an impermissible electoral activity. Those of you on the line who are in nonprofit organizations, you know that nonprofit organizations cannot engage in electoral activities. We cannot support or oppose any particular candidate. Even though a ballot measure may be on the ballot at the same time as the election of representatives or senators, presidents or governors, et cetera, it's not electoral activity. It is considered direct lobbying. But it is considered direct lobbying. So if you're taking a position on a ballot measure, then that is taking a position on lobbying. The voting public is the legislature in a ballot measure, whether that's a referenda, a bond measure, or different ballot initiatives. And so you are aiming your education or position to the voting public, so lobbying, if you're taking a position on it. Oops. Now, there are some activities that we might not think of as lobbying that do fall under the definition of lobbying. For example, if you are preparing for a lobbying activity, you're doing research on proposed legislation that's pending in a legislative body. If you are discussing public issues, formulating and agreeing upon positions, and studying those issues in preparation of adopting a position for lobbying, these can be considered time spent on lobbying. And you begin measuring a lobbying activity when the primary purpose of your preparation or research is to engage in lobbying activity. So if you know that you are doing this work, this preparation, this research, this preparing policy statements, et cetera, as part of what you intend to be a lobbying activity, then all of those activities engaged in have to count as lobbying activities. On the other hand, if you do research or material development and it was not exclusively for the purpose of lobbying, it really was for educational purposes, then the cost of that time, the cost of the research and material development, is not counted as lobbying, even if you later use it for lobbying, as long as the lobbying use happens more than 6 months after the research project or material development is completed. So say you're interested in poverty issues and you are doing research around different steps taken to increase the access to financial resources for low-income families. And you're not thinking about doing lobbying. You're really doing it as an educational activity for yourself, your members, and policymakers. And so you engage in this work and you develop a report where you make some recommendations for what kinds of steps could be taken to improve access to economic resources for low-income families. And then 6 months and a week later, there is the opportunity to use that information that you created to actually influence legislation. So if you don't use it until more than 6 months after you created it, then you don't have to count the time that you spent developing all those resources as lobbying time. The time you're spending now that you are using it to lobby, the current lobbying activities that you're engaging in, of course, you are going to count that as lobbying time, but the development of the resources themselves don't count as lobbying it because you didn't develop them to lobby and it was more than 6 months after you created them before you use them for a lobbying purpose. Now, one of the things that's important to understand is that nonprofits can lobby. And so many people have the mistaken idea that nonprofits can't lobby, and if you're a nonprofit organization, you really have your hands tied when it comes to engaging in lobbying activities, whether they are direct lobbying activities or grassroots lobbying activities. There are two answers to that. The first is that nonprofits can and should engage in lobbying. And the second is that nonprofits have to be aware of the rules and measure their lobbying activities so they can report on lobbying expenditures. And the two kinds of opportunities to lobby under the tax code for nonprofits is the 501H expenditure test or the insubstantial part test. And we're going to go into more detail about that. The 501H expenditure test means you have to count all costs, including photocopying, transportation, staff time, and overhead costs aimed at lobbying, and report on those. The insubstantial part test doesn't give any guidance on how much expenditure or how much activity is substantial. And so it actually places nonprofits at greater risk for being in trouble with the Internal Revenue Service because it's not as specific as the 501H expenditure test. So let's talk a little bit more about what we mean by these two options that are both available under the nonprofit component of the tax code. So what if you don't select this 501H expenditure test? Then if you lobby, you can lobby as long as your lobbying activities don't become a substantial part of your overall activities. This is a subjective test that is based on the circumstances and the facts of each case. One thing that we do know is that reimbursements to volunteers for out-of-pocket expenses spent on lobbying costs do count as lobbying and have to be reported. So you can lobby as long as it's not a substantial part of your overall activities. And of course, there's no guidance here about whether that is 5% of your activities, 7% of your activities, et cetera. It's a very subjective test. The factors that are included in determining whether or not it's an insubstantial part of a nonprofit's activities include the absolute amount of funds that are spent, the impact of your lobbying activities, the public prominence of your lobbying activities, and unpaid volunteer work, the amount of unpaid volunteer work that is going into lobbying activities. The 501H expenditure test is really a much safer option for nonprofits. This test only includes lobbying activity that costs money. And so unlike the insubstantial part where you have to include the value of unpaid volunteer work, if you do the 501H election, then the only money you have to count or the only cost that you have to count is lobbying activity that costs money. Now, there are limits in terms of how much money you can spend on lobbying when you pick the 501H expenditure test. If your budget is $500,000 a year or less, you can pick, it can go up to 20%. $500,000 to $1 million, you can spend up to $100,000 plus 15% of your budget over $500,000. If your budget is $1 to $1.5 million, you can spend $175,000 plus 10% of your budget over $1 million. If it's $1.5 million, if your budget's $1.5 million plus, you can spend $224,000 plus 5% of your budget over $1.5 million with a maximum of $1 million a year. Wouldn't it be great if a family organization had $1 million a year to spend on lobbying? So as you can see, this is gives you a lot of good specific information about how much you can spend on lobbying once you make the 501 expenditure election. And it's very clear, and you don't have to worry that you're getting to a place where it's no longer insubstantial. Now, of those dollars this total amount of money you can spend on lobbying. So say you're an organization that has a budget of $500,000 or less. So you can spend 20% of your budget, which is $100,000, on lobbying, up to that amount on lobbying. You can spend up to a fourth of that overall budget on grassroots lobbying. So you have to pay attention not only to the total amount of the lobbying money that you're spending, but also what percent of that is spent on grassroots lobbying versus direct lobbying. And that's why you have to care about whether something is grassroots lobbying or direct lobbying. Under the 501H expenditure test, you can also develop and disseminate a nonpartisan analysis, study, or research, or a substantive report that fully discusses the pros and cons of a legislative proposal without it being considered lobbying. Now, how do you make the 501H election? How hard is it? It's really easy. The board votes to make the election. You complete Form 5768. You make a copy. You mail it to the IRS. And then you start tracking those lobbying expenditures. So, and then this is just a reminder of the amount that you can spend on lobbying if you make the 501H election. So it's really very simple. It's not hard at all to make the 501H election, and it really provides a nonprofit with a lot more protection in the long run than trying to stay within the insubstantial part guidelines, which are very subjective. So say you've decided that you're going to engage in lobbying, but you want to limit it as much as possible. And so you want to know, how can you advocate in a way that is not lobbying? Well, one thing you can do is you can communicate to your members about legislation without a call to action. In other words, without asking them to take a position and to act on the on your information, your communication. You can seek to influence regulations or administrative rules or executive branch actions, including contacting the executive branch and even contacting legislators about executive branch actions, and that is not lobbying. Influencing school boards is also not lobbying. If you have a newspaper publish an article or an ad stating your organization's view on legislation without a call to action, that is also not lobbying. And then a self-defense activity is not lobbying as well. And so you can do things like research and analysis, and even explain pros and cons of the merits of legislation, as long as you present the facts fully and fairly, you make the material generally available and don't include a direct call to the reader of the report to contact legislators. You can discuss broad social, economic, and other policy issues. Even if the resolution of those issues would require legislation, and even if specific legislation on the matter is pending, as long as your discussion doesn't address the merits of specific legislation. And you can even talk directly to legislators on broad policy issues, as long as you're not referencing specific legislation on that issue. So there are many steps that you can take to educate the legislature, to educate the public, to provide information and analysis that would be persuasive to people about taking a position on a particular piece of legislation or policy issue, as long as you are not making a call to action or as long as you are not referencing specific legislation on that issue. Now, what about a 501H legislative scorecard? A legislative scorecard is a resource or a tool you can use to inform your members about how all relevant legislators have voted. So they're recorded legislative votes, not the campaign positions they have taken. And what your organization thinks about votes on issues of importance to your group. Don't want to issue it just before the election, because if you issue it just before the election, then it could be seen as possibly attempting to influence the election itself, which would be impermissible electoral activity. You'd want to issue it at the conclusion of a legislative cycle. And you can even score legislators in this 501H legislative scorecard to your members. And, of course, if you do this scorecard at the end of a legislative cycle, it's still going to be around when people are voting on particular legislators. But at that point, it's not impermissible electoral activity because it's a scorecard that you created before the election cycle. So the timing, of course, is very important here. Now, many nonprofits will say that they don't spend money on lobbying because they lobby on their own time, or their members lobby on their own time, or their staff lobby on their own time. So there's some important things to keep in mind. Your staff, the staff of your organization, can engage in lobbying on their own time, and it won't be charged to your organization as organizational lobbying, as long as they don't indicate their relationship to your organization and aren't directed by your organization to engage in the lobbying. Unfortunately, executive directors or high-ranking officials of your organization may be considered always on duty unless your board or personnel policies make it very clear that you do not lobby on behalf of the organization, or that any time that you spend contacting legislators on your off hours is not representative of the organization and therefore should not be counted towards organizational lobbying time. But it's very difficult to justify having an executive director be considered to be lobbying on their own time because they are so closely related to the organization that they lead. So I would really recommend that you make a differentiation in your policies between executive directors or high-ranking officials of the organization versus other staff. So Nora asked, does anyone have some sample policies where the ED could lobby on their own time? There are some sample policies that are available that we can certainly share to answer this question, Nora. I do want to reiterate, however, that there is no guarantee that even if your board or personnel policies make such an assertion, that in a case with the IRS would necessarily agree. Because remember, as the executive director, just as other staff, you could not indicate your relationship to the organization as part of your individual lobbying effort. You have to make sure that it's done in a way that doesn't seem to implicate your organization as part of the lobbying effort. Suzanne asks, how does social media posts relate to lobbying? For example, what if an employee posts something on their own page? How do we protect ourselves from the use of lobbying? Well, one thing is an employee's individual page should not represent them as being a staff person of your organization. And they should indicate in their social media posts that they are posting this as an individual so that it's very clear that they are taking this individual position and that's not intended to represent their organizational position on an issue. I see one more person typing, so before I move on, I'm going to see if it's a question related to this topic. Okay, so if an organization doesn't file a 501H document with the IRS, does the standard to the insubstantial, does the standard default to the insubstantial rule? Yes, it does default to the insubstantial rule. So if you don't pick 501H, then if there's a question about your lobbying activities, the test will be the insubstantial lobbying test. So what are some prohibited activities? Intervening in a political campaign of any candidate for public office is a prohibited activity for a nonprofit.
Okay, so you can't.
But can encourage people to vote and register people to vote, even if you are registering people to vote who are more likely to vote for one party or one candidate or the other. You cannot explicitly only register Republicans or only register Democrats, but you can register only people who live in downtown Newark or only people who live in Camden or Philadelphia or Los Angeles, et cetera. But you can't only register people from a political party, a particular political party, or a particular candidate. You can't engage in partisan activity of any kind. So you cannot post your support for one candidate over another. You also cannot use government funds to lobby, including to lobby for government grants, unless Congress expressly authorizes it. For example, Congress expressly authorizes the Councils on Developmental Disabilities to take positions on legislation as part of their mandate. But for nonprofit organizations such as us, we may not use government funds to lobby in any way, shape, or form. And that means, for example, we can't lobby to increase funding for PTIs or parent centers. We can't lobby to increase funding for F2F by using government funds. We can lobby for those things, but we have to use something other than government funds. So let's talk a little bit about registration and reporting. State and federal lobby disclosure laws also require certain organizations and individuals who are paid to lobby or whose lobbying expenses are reimbursed to register and file periodic reports on lobbying activities. So, for example, in New Jersey, our lobbying legislation goes far beyond the definition of lobbying under federal law. And so we are required to report on not just lobbying that meets the federal IRS definition of lobbying, but also whenever we meet with high administrative policymakers, which is not lobbying under IRS rules. We don't have to count that as IRS lobbying, but we have to report it to the state, and we have to report the amount of time, resources that we dedicate to that. That's a state reporting law that we have to comply with. And so in addition to understanding these rules that we've discussed today on this webinar, it's important for you also to find out what your particular state lobby disclosure laws require. Now, people often ask if there is a threshold for reporting on lobbying activities. And the easy answer is there is no minimum threshold for reporting on lobbying activities. Even though the dollar amount you spend on lobbying is small, you should report it. And that is true whether you are the insubstantial test or the 501H election. You have to report on your lobbying activities and their costs. So how do you report it? The IRS accepts any reason for reporting. You can use sampling instead of complete time records to estimate the time that's spent on lobbying. You can estimate the overhead costs that are used to support your lobbying activities. But as much as possible, especially as you get to higher amounts that are spent on lobbying, you want to use the actual costs when possible. So if you do any lobbying under either test, you should have a mechanism to capture and report on the amount of time that's spent, the dollars that are used to disseminate material, staff time, printing, postage, indirect or overhead costs for your use of your internet service, et cetera. You do need to collect that on an ongoing basis, and everybody who's engaged as well as your executive director. Now, in the Lobbying Disclosure Act of 1995, if you have any employee that spends at least 20% of their time on federal lobbying activities, and you spend $22,500 or more over 6 months on that lobbying activity, they have to register as a lobbyist and file those particular lobbyist reports that are required by the Lobbying Disclosure Act of 1995. I think it's not that likely that we have people on the line who have an employee that spends at least 20% of their time on federal lobbying activities and they spend more than $22,500 over 6 months on that lobbying activity. But if so, then they have to register and report, file the reports that are required by that law. I just want to go back to this, how to report. We do have a sample tool that you can use to capture your lobbying expenditures. And if anybody is interested in accessing that, then you can certainly reach out to us and we will make it available to you. So what happens if you are sanctioned by the IRS because you do not follow the rules regarding lobbying? If you are a non-electing nonprofit, in other words, you do not select the 501H election, then there is a 5% tax on your excessive lobbying spending. So that's whatever amount of lobbying costs the IRS determines is above insubstantial. And there can also be a similar tax on managers who willfully and unreasonably agree to those lobbying expenditures. If you are in a 501H election organization, then there's a 25% excise tax on lobbying spending in excess of the ceiling. Now, there is something that's called the death sentence, and it's not an individual death sentence. You are not personally put in the blocks. However, you lose your nonprofit exemption if your spending normally exceeds 150% of either the overall limit or the grassroots limit over a four-year period. Jeremy has asked, does that disclosure rule apply to state government lobbying or only federal lobbying? It's any lobbying that you're doing. The IRS test is local, county, state, and national lobbying. Even though it's federal IRS rules, it applies. The IRS has given us a nonprofit status. We can only have that status if we abide by the rules for nonprofits. That includes the lobbying rules, and those lobbying rules apply to any lobbying that's conducted at any level. And one of our board members has suggested that we put the tool in the resources section of the National Place website, which is parentsatthetable.org, and we will do that. So you won't have to reach out to us to try to get that resource. We'll just put it in the resources section in the materials connected to the recording of this webinar. So you see that it's pretty important that you don't exceed either the overall spending for lobbying or the grassroots limit over a four-year period, because then you could actually lose your nonprofit status. So how can we fund lobbying? Since we can't use any government funds to influence legislation, and generally those of us who get foundation grants, there's something that we find when we get that grant that often will say that we can't use foundation funds to lobby. So how can we fund our lobbying activities? And there is this really great resource guide calling the Mercifully Brief Real World Guide to Raising Thousands, if Not Tens of Thousands of Dollars with Email, which is a resource I recommend. You can use funds that are generated by fee-for-service activities. So, for example, if you do professional development for school districts or hospitals or nurses or people who work in your child welfare agency, the funds that you earn by those activities, which you can do as a nonprofit, are funds that you can use for any purpose. Even though a government agency may pay you to do that activity, it's just like they would pay somebody who built a state building or did cleaning of those buildings. The fee-for-service money that you generate as a nonprofit organization can be used for lobbying. Certainly contributions can be used for lobbying. People can make a contribution to your organization, and those are funds that you can use for lobbying, unless they put a particular restriction on the use of the funds. Your membership dues, if you're a membership organization, your membership dues can be used for lobbying. If you sell materials, those can be used for lobbying. So you can use funds for lobbying activities if you raise them in a way other than government grant contracts, foundation funds, et cetera. There are some foundation grants that are intended to support direct or grassroots lobbying, but that's really a rarity. It will be interesting to see if that increases some over the next few years, given the many issues that we are dealing with on a legislative level right now. But most foundation funds do not allow you to use those grants for lobbying. So even if you want to do a small amount of lobbying, you have to make sure that those funds don't come out of your government grants or foundation funds unless they explicitly allow you to do that. So that's one of the reasons why it's really great for nonprofits to generate other kinds of funds, like by doing workshops or other types of support in a fee-for-service manner, contributions, membership dues, sale of materials, your annual fundraiser, et cetera. Those are all ways that you can raise funds that you can use to lobby. And no nonprofit should be without some funds that you can use to lobby. So you have some other options as well. If a legislative body, either the majority or minority members of the committee, invite you in writing to express your opinion on a particular piece of legislation or policy issues, that's known as technical advice, and it's not counted as lobbying. You're invited by the legislative body. You can respond to that invitation, but that invitation has to be in writing. And then even though you are expressing your opinion on a particular piece of legislation, it is not counted as lobbying. It's also possible to set up something called a 501c4, where there are no restrictions on the amount of lobbying that you can do, but it's important to remember that gifts to a 501c4 are not tax deductible. And so it's going to be, it may be more difficult to get funds if you set up a 501c4. In this call, we're not going to go into a lot of detail about 501c4, just letting you know that there is an option to set such an organization up. It has unlimited restrictions for the amount of lobbying, but any gifts to that 501c4 are not tax deductible. The tax deductible nonprofits, such as the organizations on this line, or are 501c3 organizations. You can find out some information about additional limits or reporting requirements from your state association of nonprofit organizations, and most states do have an association of nonprofits. You can also find out more at Boulder Advocacy, www.boulderadvocacy.org, which has some additional information about lobbying. And before we ask people if there are particular questions, the takeaway messages are, as a nonprofit organization, you can and should engage in public policy advocacy and lobbying. For most nonprofits, you should do the 501H election. And now more than ever, when so many changes are happening in legislation across all of the issues and systems that impact children and families, there are going to be many, many more opportunities, and there's going to be much greater interest in lobbying, and you want to protect yourself as much as possible, and therefore you should do the 501H election. And it's easy to do the 501H election, so there's no reason why you shouldn't do the 501H election. Doing the 501H election doesn't require that you lobby. It just means that if and when you lobby, it's going to be a lot clearer what your limits are in terms of how much money you can spend in the lobbying activity. And remember that you have to report lobbying activities with your tax return as an organization, regardless of whether you make the 501H election and no matter how little you spend on lobbying. So some other resources that you can use to find out more about lobbying and nonprofits: the Alliance for Justice, Independent Sector, and even the IRS. Their charity section on their website has some good information and some guidance that's pretty understandable. So just encouraging you not to sit on the sidelines and get into the game. Remember, even in these difficult and shifting times, that empowering family members to participate in advocacy for their children, their community, and the larger society is its own victory, regardless of the specific outcome of any particular effort. Democracy is not a spectator sport. We have to live it and breathe it in order to keep it. I want to remind you about the upcoming webinars in the Being the Difference series. On March 30th, we are going to present effective grassroots advocacy. And on April 13th, the power of stories. Stories are much more likely to influence policymakers and legislators than facts and figures or research studies. These two webinars are going to be free to National Place members, and we have a exciting $100 introductory year membership for statewide and local family-led organizations, and you can join us at parentsatthetable.org/join-us. If you're not a member, then it's $50 for each webinar for non-members. And if you add that up, you see it's $100. So if you plan to come to both of those webinars, it makes it worth your while to join National Place. And you can register for the webinar the same place that you registered for this webinar. This is just the homepage of our National Place website, www.parentsatthetable.org. In addition to information about who we are, upcoming events, why you should join us, we have some great resources on research and how-tos on engaging family organizations and families in issues that affect children and families, divided by child welfare, health, education, human services, child care, et cetera, and so you can find those resources. They're on our website free. You don't have to be a member to access those resources, and so we encourage you to visit our website, parentsatthetable.org. And at this point, just going to see if there are any remaining questions from any of the participants and let you know that after we close the webinar, we're going to be sending you a link to an evaluation of the webinar, which we hope has provided you with information that is going to be useful to you as you think about whether or not you want to lobby and how you want to lobby and make sure that you protect your organization as you lobby. So does anybody have any other questions or comments that you want to raise at this time? Nobody has any questions? I have some questions that people are typing. All right. Hearing no individual questions or comments, you'll see in the chat box that we're asking you to take a moment to take a survey about today's webinar. Okay, so Jeremy asks, does discussing a state appropriation for your organization with the legislator count as lobbying? Yes, state appropriations are budget issues, and discussing budget issues with the legislator counts as lobbying. So the answer to that is yes. Victoria recommends A Voice for Nonprofits. Thank you for that recommendation. And again, please take the survey about today's webinar. Nora, do you want to make any last comments before we close the webinar?
No, I just, can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Yeah. We can hear you, Nora. Did you have anything you wanted to say, Nora?
Now can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I want to thank everybody who joined us today, and most especially I want to thank Diana for this presentation. The information it's a lot to process, but it's really important, and it's the start of showing us that we have to take action. So take the evaluation, and we hope to see all of you and more on our next webinar, which is going to be about grassroots advocacy. So with that, I want to say thanks, everyone.
And we will have the PowerPoint, the recording, the tool that we talked about for tracking lobbying available on the webinar available on our website within the next week. And remember, more information about National Place, parentsatthetable.org. And thank you all for joining.
Thanks. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.